Hello and a very warm welcome to episode number 540 of the Minter Dialogue podcast. I am Minter Dial and I'm your host for this podcast, a most proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. For more information or to check out other shows on the network, please go over and visit their site, evergreenpodcasts.com. First, I'd like to give a quick shout out and thanks for putting up a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts by Valingmun. So this week's interview is with Sir William Russell. Will was Lord Mayor of the City of London 2019 to 2021 and is currently Alderman of Bread Street Ward. He's also board member of City UK, deputy chair of the Barbican Centre, and a non-executive director at Augmentum FinTech. Will was a classmate and housemate of mine back at my time at Eton College, where we shared many experiences on the sports field, amongst others. In this conversation with Will, we discuss his fascinating career, the influence of sports on his life, his appreciation of working for American companies, what makes an effective leader today, the important challenges of boards of governors, the impact of Brexit, as well as his experience in being knighted by the King. You'll find all the show notes on MinterDial.com. And please, if you have a little moment, go over and drop in a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show. Will Russell, who would have thought? Oh gosh, how many years ago was it we met? We were stumbling teenagers running around in our school in tails. And life has led us to, well, it led you to have an extraordinary career. In your own words, Will, who are you?
So who am I, Minter? Lovely to see you and to be with you. And yes, who would have believed it all those years ago? So I am Alderman Sir William Russell, and I'm an Alderman of the City of London. My career has, started in our running shorts, I suppose, at Eton College and then Durham University. And then I joined the financial services. I worked out that the best people to work for are the Americans, so first Boston and Merrill Lynch. And then I decided in 2006 it was time to do something different, and did a lot around charity. So I'm a past chairman of Prostate Cancer UK, and then deputy chair of Place to Be, which is a mental health charity. But the big moment in my life was when I decided to stand as Alderman of the City of London. And we can talk about that a bit more. I don't want to bore anyone, but it dates back hundreds of years, the City of London, and the Court of Aldermen is where they select the Lord Mayor of the City of London. And I was sheriff in 2016 and then became Lord Mayor in 2019 for 2 years because of COVID, which was a huge privilege and an honour, and one of the oldest offices in the UK. Dates back to 1189, and I was the 692nd Lord Mayor of the great City of London.
And so it was also a two-term stint, which is very rare as well.
Yes, because of COVID, I was asked if I would do another year. And the last time that happened was 1860, 1861. And that was William Cubitt. And many of the listeners will know that William Cubitt built Cubitt Town down on the Isle of Dogs, but also developed Pimlico and Belgravia. He was from a wealthy building family. And Lueni asked me, why was he asked to do another year? And I say, because his largesse to the city, because you had to pay for everything yourself in those days, was so great. They said, give him another year, whereas I was probably the cheapest Lord Mayor for many years. But there were a number of Lord Mayors who did 2 years back to back. But of course, the most famous Lord Mayor, which is Dick Whittington, did 4 years in total, but he did do back-to-back years in 1397 and 1398. And I never thought in my wildest dreams I would have anything in common apart from being Lord Mayor, but had to have done 2 years like Dick Whittington.
Absolutely stunning. So what does the Lord Mayor of the City of London do? I mean, it's obviously related to the financial sector, I would say. But tell us, give us an idea of what was your life like?
So you move into the Mansion House, which is opposite the Bank of England, down in the bank. And the Mansion House dates back to sort of the 18th century, was built because the city decided that the Lord Mayor should have his or her own residence. But your major task is you are the ambassador for financial and professional services for the whole of the UK, not just the City of London. And I remind people that that employs about 2.3 million people, of which two thirds of those employees are outside the City of London. It's 8% of the GDP of our country, 11% of our tax take. It is a huge sector. In fact, it is the largest sector for the UK. And many people know financial services it has been a critical part of the UK's success. And that includes the law, and the rule of law is one of our greatest strengths. But it also includes the insurance sector, which sometimes gets forgotten. And that's 27% of the GDP of the financial of financial and professional services. It's a huge business and hugely successful, Lloyd's of London.
So you're 2019-20, we're post Brexit, and I, you know, so much of the press talks about it, the departure of all these European or worldwide financial services to European centers. How much of that is true, and how is the financial services sector being so strong surviving this post-Brexit world?
So, look, I was a Romania, but I try not to be a Ramona. But Brexit hasn't helped us, in my opinion. And as Jamie Dimon said when I was Lord Mayor, I had a meeting with him. Jamie Dimon said, "We love London. We think it's just London's great, but don't think that the Macrons of the world and other countries aren't going to just chip away." And I'm afraid that's what's happening. It was never going to be this sudden burst of where some people came out and said we'd lose 80,000 jobs overnight. I think it's less than 10,000. But you can see this drift now. As everyone knows, Brexit was back in 2016, but we didn't really come out officially until January 2020. But you can see that there is a drift. However, I'm not going to do London down, because London is the greatest city in the world. And the key reason why I'm still optimistic about London and financial professional services is because we attract that global talent. And it's all about talent. And as long as we are attracting that global talent to London, then I think we'll be fine. However, I could argue, funny enough, and this will sound like a Brexit argument, but I could argue that even if we hadn't left Europe, London would have lost a bit of market share, because if you look at people's risk registers, how could you have so much of your eggs in the London basket, so to speak? So I always think that Frankfurt and Paris and other cities were going to start to benefit from that anyway, that migration away. The one that everyone's really watching is the clearing. But at the moment, even the big European banks are saying, you know, we can't do this. This is, you know, it will cost us and we'll be less competitive. And, you know, where has the talk about EU capital markets gone? And we all know about listings. It's not just London. I mean, look at Amsterdam. Listings around the world have dropped dramatically. But I still think that that London will survive. We've got a very successful fintech sector. We're still the tech center of Europe. And the investments in fintech are still higher than the rest of Europe put together. So, you know, it's not ideal, but it's not a disaster. So I think we'll still be fine. But you know, our competition will, whether it's Dublin, Amsterdam, Paris and Frankfurt, will continue to chip away at us. And, you know, who would blame them? I'd do the same.
It's fair game. So you talked about the ability to attract talent. It's quite a hot topic, the ability to attract talent in today's world. All these businesses are struggling to attract the top talent because they're still not flexible enough, or they're not providing enough amenities and foosball tables or whatever it takes. What sort of talent do you find that London is attracting? And in the financial world, fintech included, what about attracting coders? Because there's a lot of talk in the press about, coders are not a lot of people want to come to London. These are people. We have to import talent from other countries. Clean this up.
So I'm not an expert on the coding thing, but I am involved in businesses that are based, particular businesses, it's based in Europe. And I mean, the thing about the coders is they can code from anywhere. So London's an expensive city, there's no doubt about it. But many of our fintech companies have people working for them they were in the Ukraine, but whether it's Bulgaria, whether it's Croatia, which has become a big tech talent hub as well. And obviously the wages are cheaper and all that. But I think the ecosystem, and this is where I come back to, in London is unique. You have all the law firms, you have all the asset managers, you have and there's a reason why the likes of HSBC and Clifford Chance are moving from Canary Wharf back into the city, is because they recognise that ecosystem is unique. I'm here in the city now. I can if I have a meeting, I just walk out of my door and go and meet one of the firms around the corner, and I think that's worth a lot. The other thing I would say is, we have a history, and that history is also worth a lot. And I always used to say Brexit, one thing Brexit can't do is take our history away. I mean, people like the history. Look, we just had the coronation. How many people, tourists, has that brought to the UK and particularly to London when they watch on television, our wonderful king and the coronation? So don't underestimate what I call that soft convening power. And I think if you ask me, as when I was Lord Mayor, what is the thing you picked up, one of the things you picked up the most, it was that soft convening power of the mayoralty. People would come to the Mansion House and I'd host heads of state. I hosted Zelensky in October 2021, obviously not knowing what was going to happen. So we're part of the not part of government, but the government uses us as part of that soft convening power that we offer when people visit the country, and that gets replicated when you go overseas, whether it's to Kuwait or to Saudi or to the UAE or many other countries. I mean, as Lord Mayor, in a normal time, and mine wasn't a normal time, you travel over 100 days of the year promoting financial and professional services. So I think the talent wants to come here. And the final thing I'll say about that is, and I'm deputy chair of the Barbican Centre, and I've always loved the arts and culture. And when I was Lord Mayor, I chaired the Culture and Commerce Task Force. Is commerce is beginning to realise that it's not just about coming into the office, and it's more than that. And each of these big corporations need to earn the commute, and it's about purpose. It's changed dramatically, Minta, from the days that you and I were working for financial services, and I think that's a positive. And I think that many companies and want their employees to be happy, to enjoy coming into the office. What else can they offer them? Look at all the whole conversation and the stigma that's been lifted about mental health, which there was no mental health discussion when you and I were at the coalface. And so the world's changed, and London is able to provide all that. And I think that's one of its greatest benefits. I mean, I don't know, I'm sure you have probably been to New York recently. I haven't, but everyone says New York is just a tip at the moment. And, London is got the new Elizabeth line. It's, we're still, we do ourselves down. It's classic British sort of thing to do. We actually need to be a bit more upbeat and recognize how lucky we are to have what we have.
Well, that would be a good conduit to talk about why you said working for First Boston and Merrill Lynch. I worked at DLJ.
Yeah.
Beginning of my career. Why did you say that was the American style is good? I mean, reputed that way.
No. Also, in those days when we were all leaving university, we were trying to work out who the winners were going to be. And to be frank, who were going to pay you best. And I think the American culture is much more meritocratic. The UK banks, of which there aren't many left, if there are any left, in fact, not the commercial banks, but investment banks, you know, there was always a little bit, oh, we can't pay him or her that amount of money because, it, you know, they're too junior. Whereas the Americans would say, you know, it's the American culture, which I appreciated. You know, you deliver, we'll pay you. Doesn't matter how old you are. And, you know, it was a very good time that you and I were in the financial services working for the Americans. And they were that's how they worked. And I love that culture. You know, each banks have different cultures. I was never going to be a Goldman's person, but Merrill Lynch was a wonderful, wonderful place to work and have lots of many friends from there still. While I'm on the Americans, that's the other thing, is that a lot of everyone predicted all these banks would open headquarters elsewhere. And, you know, I think many J.P. Morgan's obviously opened a couple of big offices in Paris. You know, a lot of the American employees, and I'll regale a story, and I think it was one of the big American banks where they said, you know, we want to, said to a director, we want to move you to Frankfurt. And the director said, well, that's absolutely fine. I'll commute. My family stays here in London. And you know, that is partly the strength of London.
And of course, you referred to Jamie Dimon earlier, who I guess was the CEO of JP Morgan Chase. Is that correct? Or is he still?
He still is. Very much so. God, JP Morgan. I mean, he's one of my heroes. He's incredible.
He's a titan.
And he is a titan. And what he's created is extraordinary. So anyway, yeah.
So I want to follow on because you mentioned this idea of purpose. And Will, if I were to be entirely frank, my opinion is that financial services companies haven't really figured out or remembered what their purpose, their genuine uplifting purpose is. Tell me I'm wrong.
No, I mean, I think different banks have different views. But I do think, funny enough, I mean, you all know, and I know many hedge fund managers who are hugely successful, who are below the radar, and their philanthropy is absolutely phenomenal. They just don't talk about it. And so I do think that there is a culture where those who have done very well, successfully set up their foundations and help others. When I talk about purpose, it's more around the individual rather than the banks, but the individual can then influence the bank or influence the company they're working for. And I do think that in our day, totally agree with you, there was a less sense of a purpose. But if you're going to employ, you know, some of these bright new graduates, they want to know that the company is doing more than just paying them big bonuses. And what else is there that they can do for the community? For those, you know, a lot of companies do get involved, have a charity of the year, but part of that involves volunteering so that their employees can volunteer. I know that BlackRock does a lot of that. And I think it has changed, but the change has been forced by the new employees. They aren't going to get the best talent if they don't have more of a sense of purpose. So it's in their interest. It's a bit like diversity and inclusion. You know, all the data is out there that the more diverse and inclusive your workforce is, the results are better. So why wouldn't you do it? So I think that goes hand in hand. So now that, you know, data is so important to look at, I think companies have worked out that, you know, having more of a sense of purpose, having better diversity and inclusion actually improves results. And that's ultimately what they're looking to do.
Yeah, there's this sort of sense of pragmatism to some of these, let's say, trendy topics like diversity, inclusion, and equality, or CSR, corporate sustainable development programs, or even having purpose. If you can prove that it's useful, well, in the financial services, I can get that. Yet I would say that doing charities isn't making your business, your core business, purposeful. It's sort of like an add-on that allows you to have purpose, but it doesn't like insurance companies, for example, Will. In the past, their purpose was to allow for adventure, to allow for people to explore the world in a way that was financially possible. That was their purpose. That's a big old purpose. Today, that's, you know, maybe entirely lost in the small print.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you may be right. I mean, I think I look at the insurance sector and see how that's evolved over the last 20, 30 years into this huge sector that a lot of people now go immediately to. Whereas I always remember at university, and no offense to anyone who's listening to this, who's in the insurance world, but, you know, you went to insurance because, you know, it was a place of last resort rather than going into investment banking or doing other things around the city. But that's not the case anymore. I mean, you know, Marsh McLennan, Aon, and all these great firms are recruiting some of the best talent. So, you know, the investment banks are competing with them now. But, you know, I know a lot of people at Aon, and they have a great culture. And they've had to adapt and change to attract that talent, particularly female talent, because the insurance sector, who I'm sure they'd be the first to admit, didn't have a great reputation. But that reputation is changing, and they're becoming much more inclusive.
Well, a little wink to my daughter, Alexandra, who is currently looking at insurance companies herself. Okay. So a big smile.
I said the right thing. You can tell her that you didn't prime me.
Too true. So, Will, going back a little bit, you mentioned prostate cancer you worked with and your work at Barbican. You probably get, I'm going to guess, about one a day, some kind of proposition. Hey, Sir Will, can you join this? Can you do this? Can you speak about us, your position of influence, obviously your network, what you do and who you are, makes that an obvious request. But how do you sort through those?
I wish, and you've built me up into this person who gets all these requests, which isn't the case. Firstly, I don't go looking for anything. I'm a big fatalist, and I always think that something will happen, and you'll just know. And so that happens quite a bit. But I have a rule, and it drives my wife mad, that on the whole I say yes to everything as far as meeting people, because when as Lord Mayor, there were many occasions when one was speaking to groups of young people or people, graduates, and they always would ask the question, you know, what is the best piece of advice you can give us as we go forward in life? And I always say the same, and I say it to my children, or have said it to my children, and they're pretty good at it, is that if you're invited to something, always say yes, because you never know when you go to that event who you're going to meet, how you could change their life, but also they could change your life. You know, that's really important. And now, you know, you and I were fortunate enough to have the education we've had, and we were brought up with what I call a networking view. And you could argue that our old school is probably one of the greatest networks that we've ever had. However, many people in the world don't have that luck and that fortunate way that we were brought up. And I think it's really true. I think, you know, you need to be out there and building your network. If you look back at history, you know, it's all about the network. And there's a very good book which I read, and I can't remember who wrote it. I think it was Ferguson wrote it, about the network. And it goes back in history, whether it's the Romans or the Greeks. Think about, you know, whether they didn't have the social media that we had, but, you know, whether they're going to the marketplace or the Roman Forum, you know, they were all networking. And I think that's one of the pieces of advice I always give to people, is be out there, show your face, and you never know what might come your way.
How much do you understand the future of finance? I'm Jim Roos, a top 10 banking influencer and host of the podcast Banking Transformed, where we dive deeply into the rapidly evolving world of banking and financial technology. Join me as I interview industry experts, thought leaders, and innovators as they unravel the latest banking trends, disruptions, and game-changing technologies reshaping the world of finance. Redefine your understanding of the banking ecosystem. Subscribe now to Banking Transformed, available wherever you get your podcasts, and now available on YouTube.
So it's interesting you use the word fatalistic. I would characterize it perhaps more positively, being the Yank that I am, as opportunistic.
Yes, that's probably a better word, yeah.
And yet you have to deal with choice, because, I mean, for example, maybe you're not getting a request today to join a board, but you're probably getting at least a request today to be joined up on LinkedIn. And I feel like,
at least.
Yeah. And that, then how do you select that? I mean, for me, what I've learned is good networking is to network openly, but only connect with people you know and trust.
So I think I'm beyond that stage in LinkedIn. I wish I could say I only connect with people I know and trust. I mean, I don't connect with everyone on LinkedIn. By the way, I think LinkedIn is brilliant, and I'm a massive fan. What an acquisition by Microsoft all those years ago. Very smart, and it just gets better and better. You know, I can't remember the last time that I even looked at Facebook. LinkedIn, for the world that you and I are in, is a huge tool. And when I just got reelected as Alderman of Bread Street, and rather than have my own website, I just I linked in with all my voters, and everything was done on LinkedIn, which was maybe not a huge amount of interest to other people on my LinkedIn. But you know, people know what you're doing. I mean, the number of times that I've met people and said, "Oh yeah, God, I see you were doing this and that." So, you know, and I'm the same, you know, you can see what people are up to on LinkedIn without necessarily having to reply to them. It's up to you what you read. But so I'm probably not as selective. I am selective of that. But, you know, sometimes I think it is a weakness, because as much as there are good people out there are some bad people too. But I'm basically always look for the good in people. That sometimes does come, and a couple of times has come back to bite me. And in today's world, you have to be a little careful. I try not to be too cynical, but on the whole, I will give people a chance. You can find out pretty quickly whether they're wrongs or not. But on the whole, I always just go for it and see what happens. But LinkedIn, you can see what's going on with LinkedIn is people just go for it across the board and want to have as many. It's a bit like Instagram, isn't it, really? Mm. You want as many followers or LinkedIn members, and then you can put other product out there. So it's going to be interesting how that evolves over the next year or so.
Yeah, you do get the feeling that it involves, or it allows for more and more personal things as well.
Yeah, which is not what it's about.
Right. But, as soon as you can allow a little bit more emotion into it, it creates more engagement. Yeah. You're not going to show your dogs and your cats.
No. I mean, I think showing yourself on a holiday, that was Facebook. Yeah. And I see that more as Instagram.
Or Instagram,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, but it's not LinkedIn. And on the whole, people keep to it, but you do get the odd one and you see, oh, gosh, you know, mm-hmm. I think they've got the wrong platform for whatever they put out there. So,
Will, one of the shared things you and I have is a passion for sports. Yeah. Newly, of course, with the other game from those Spanish people, El Padel. But more specifically, you were an outstanding sportsman and still are during our school years. And I was just wondering what's your narrative as to what sports brought to you as an individual?
So, I mean, it's a team ethic, really. I love, paddle, you're playing, and the two of you are playing a team. It's a smaller team, but I think it's that ability to work with the team. And when there's a victory, it's not down to the individual. It's down to all of you pulling together. And actually that is a very good segue into, you know, your job life. You know, when I was at Merrill Lynch and I was in charge of a desk, you know, how do you bring that team together? You work together, you be collaborative. And I think that's one of the great joys of sport, that it ingrains that into you. I always remember when I was interviewing people, I would always ask about sport and the team ethic. Because you don't want an individual joining your team. You want somebody who will slot into the team and work with everybody. And I think that's where sport is a very powerful tool. And you know, I was fortunate enough to see the women at the Euro finals last year. But I love what's going on in women's sport. I just think that's brilliant. It's been far too long getting to where we're going. We've still got a long way to go. But I think that's hugely positive when I hear of you know, all these women playing football. And I think, you know, back in 1972, women weren't allowed to play football. I think it's even during our lifetime, terrifyingly. Or they weren't allowed to play on the boys' pitches or whatever it is. But, you know, so there's been a huge change. And I think that's great. And so sport does bring that to the table, that whole team ethic.
Yeah, well, you typically were playing larger team sports, as in cricket and rugby.
Yeah.
11 and 15, for those who don't know that sport. And that obviously seems smaller on a paddle court. But I tend to think that actually the team on the paddle court is all four of you. And
yes.
At some level, sports is also entertainment for spectators as we get into it. And much like I've been approaching the idea of conversations, where I am conversing with you, I also think that above us, you and me, Will, is a third concept, like a meta. So what is our conversation looking like? And so when you're in a paddle court, you're playing with your partner, and you have these other two on the other side, it's also about playing with them, especially, let's say, in a recreational space, to make the game for all of us better.
Yeah, no, I think you can see that. It depends how competitive you are meant to, really. If you want to be absolutely ruthless and finish off the point, I'm sure on many occasions you can. But then there's a side of you where, you know, it's good to keep the rally going because it makes it more fun. So, and if you're playing that sort of in paddle, you can have the mixture of that. Look, when I'm playing with Alistair when I'm playing with my son Nicholas against Alistair and Ed, you know, we still have great rallies, but I assure you, Nicholas and I want to win just as much as Alistair and Ed.
Well, this is presumably material for the Joy of Paddle podcast. And I would say that in paddle, my observation is that if you are trying to win too much, you can quickly lose because you're trying for the winners, whereas there's just sort of the other side of just putting it back.
Yes, the deft touch. Waiting for the moment.
We will see one another on a paddle court shortly, I am sure. So what about leadership? So obviously you captained many sides in your career in sports, and then you've had these positions of leadership in business and in public. How would you describe what makes for an effective leader today? You mentioned that Jamie Dimon was a hero of yours. How would you describe great leadership, effective leadership today?
So, I mean, the obvious point for me is leading from the front and setting the example. I think that is an important part of it. And then I always use one word, which is communication. If you can't communicate with your people, then you can't lead. Simple as that. So to me, you know, that is the most critical. So whether you're communicating where you want to take people, whether you're communicating what the business plan is, whether you're communicating so many things is around communication. And also that part of that communication is the other word, listening. Because if you aren't a listener, then you aren't going to understand your people. And you know, we all could be better listeners. My goodness, I mean, I could be a much better listener, and it's definitely something where I try and work at it, because the phrase, if you aren't listening, you aren't learning, and I think that or if you're talking, you aren't learning sometimes. I mean, it's the same thing. So those would be the two things. I mean, you know, there are masses of books being written about leadership. I think that a lot of it's around personality. I'm always optimistic, enthusiastic. You know, you've got to smile. And the final thing I'll say on the leadership front is that, and I say this to many people, but if you're kind to people when you need that favor, they'll deliver for you. But if you're too hard on people, and you upset people, and today's world has changed from the days of, you know, cracking the whip. You have to bring people with you in a kind way, because to be frank, you know, when you're trying to push on a particular area and you need their help or their hard work running into something you're doing in a week's time, they aren't going to they aren't going to be there for you when you need them.
You make me think. So you use the word kind in German, Kinder, the children, and I feel like that's the connecting tissue. If you remain curious, you therefore will want to listen, ask questions like a child, and so being a kind person could include someone who is able to listen.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And ask questions is critical. How many times have you sat next to, I've sat next to many people in my career, and particularly in the last 5 or 6 years, and Hillary, my wife, has, and men, I'm afraid, are probably worse at this than women. But she sat next to, at the end of the evening, I always say to her, so how was your evening? And she says, he knows everything about, I know everything about him, and he knows nothing about me. That is, I always like to leave a dinner party or a dinner thinking I know more about the person I've sat next to than they know about me, just because I've been asking questions.
I so agree. And the funny or the ironic element your wife was talking about is that more than likely that same man will say, oh, you're absolutely fascinating. I love you.
Yeah.
Knowing absolutely zilch.
About them. Yeah.
Right. So leadership, you talk about communication. And in this notion, there are several buzzwords that people like to use, like authentic and transparent.
Yes. Yeah.
How do you qualify what is good communication these days? I mean, is it all out there?
Yeah. So, I mean, I like to think I'm pretty authentic. You see what you get, and you know me well enough. And I think you're the same. Transparency is an interesting one. I mean, I'm pretty transparent. Transparency is how much information do you ultimately want to disclose, in my view. We could be totally transparent and put everything out there. Sometimes that's not the right thing to do. But I think you have to be more transparent than obviously 20, 30 years ago, and people will push back and say, you know, you're telling me to do this, but, you know, let's go through, can you tell me the reasons why? And they can question you, and the days of don't question me, just get on with it, they're gone, and you've got to explain why. I think you're absolutely, and that's part of the transparency. I think if you're too much of an open book, then there doesn't leave anything else for, you know, you just have to be careful. I'm pretty much an open book, but that's more my style. But I'm sure there are other leaders who do it in a different way.
Well, if we look at the issue of choice, because time is limited, listening forever, you never get anything done. If you're all you're doing is only listening, as opposed to making a decision or as a politician stating what your position is, because at one point you actually have to get off the pot and, you know, you come out with it. And then when you're communicating with someone and you're not fully transparent, or you're trying to be too transparent, well, there is a line, and you need to know, there's not just the legal lines, but you need to know where that line is and how far you're willing to go. And I think a lot of people are getting pulled into transparency because that's the demand and there's an agenda behind it. And putting that more explicit line, at least for you, how far you want to go, I feel is a key element of being authentic.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, on the communication front, it's a question of how you want to communicate. I mean, I still have and call me old school, but I still have a view that if I get an email that, and remember, I always say this to people as well, there is no emotion in email. And now we've got emojis, there's a bit more emotion, I suppose. But if I get an email that is out there and I think is a bit too, you know, is a bit too rude or tough, I never reply to that email. I always pick up the telephone. Always have a call. I just think there's so much more you can, you know, you then you can understand the emotion and you can deal with it, whereas on email you can't.
Well, other idea would be not to send immediately when you're hot-headed.
I don't know. I agree. I never do that. Never do that.
I can imagine. But you've mentioned several sort of, let's say, conservative ideas. That, and, you know, the challenge of today is we're going to get looked at like old men. But things like being present, you said you want to work and live in the city to be close and have, you know, let's see, that the networking that's in person. There's a solid element of in real life to that, as well as calling as opposed to the email.
No, I think that's right. There is, definitely. I mean, look, I'm very pro everyone coming back to the office. I think Fridays is going to be tricky, but I think if we can get Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, then that's a great result. What's going to happen is people who aren't coming back to the office are going to realize their contemporaries are getting promoted and getting paid more. And, you know, if you aren't there and part of that network and that culture of communicating face to face with people, then you'll lose out.
Yeah, I think this is going to be one of the more grisly, difficult issues facing business leaders for the next couple of years. That's for sure. Will, I wanted to talk to you about leadership again, but split down the idea between leadership and business and leadership as a politician. I mean, I hope that's an okay term for you.
A very small, minor politician on the basis that there are politics within the City of London Corporation, but I'm elected, but it's not quite like the politics down the road in Westminster.
Right. Yet you, so where I wanted to focus this particular piece is when you're running a business as a leader, it's generally all down to you. At least you must take full responsibility for everything that's happening in your company. Even though you may not be agreeing with everything, that you have to take responsibility. That is you're ultimately the fall guy and therefore the person who has the right to make definitive calls. In politics in general, as a leader, you have this kind of difficult two-wayness that seems to be more apparent than in business, where you have to say, this is my platform, this is what I believe, this is what I want to do, and then you get elected. And yet you're trying to represent the elected population, the people who have elected you. So how do you propose and represent at the same time?
Propose and represent. Well, I mean, you start off by saying when you get elected and having just recently been elected, saying things that you think you can deliver on. So on my recent election as alderman in the Great Ward of Bread Street, which is just by Paternoster Square, the things I actually spent most of the time telling about were things I'd already achieved. And I wanted to be re-elected so I could continue to do those things, but achieve more. So I do think, I mean, I like to think that I put things out there, like, you know, I'm deputy chair of the Barbican. I hope to chair the Barbican next year. What can I continue to do around mental health? So I like to think that, you know, I put things out there that I can deliver on. And that's more my style. Whereas in today's world of the febrile politics down in Westminster, they say a whole lot of things that they can't possibly deliver on. You know, and I think that's very sad. But, you know, you just have to look across the water and, you know, the Republican candidate for president. And, I mean, say a whole lot of things that can't possibly deliver on and says the whole way it works. So it has changed. So in a way, I rather like, I rather like in the city and the way it works in the city. I rather like the idea that, you know, this is small picture, obviously, compared to the global stage or even Westminster. But you can say things and hopefully deliver them. So it's a lot easier than the big politics that other people are involved in, which I've thought about many times. And I assure you, it didn't take me very long to say I'm not interested.
So no scoops on this podcast.
No.
Well, you know, the issue, I think, that is that generally speaking, democracy's under siege. And if there's no accountability possible, including through the media, to hold politicians to promises made or things, statements said, and I understand you, I think you're on the board of City AM or some newspaper?
City UK. Yeah, not the newspaper. City UK, which is... is the association that deals with financial professional services for the whole of the UK.
So. I see. Well, so let's talk about the work that you do when you're on as a board of governor, because the issue, or generally speaking, is the board of governors is supposedly there to oversee the selection of the CEO, generally over there to look at the longer term issues. And I was just wondering from your experience, Will, as opposed to the executive in the business, what are their main challenges and preoccupations facing boards these days?
Oh, gosh, that's a big question.
Sorry, maybe too vast.
No. I'm just thinking. I mean, I always think that sustainability in the environment is one of the big issues for any board. I think... the state and health, mental health of one's employees is a very important bad, and also where one is taking the company going forward in an environment that is really very tough and probably going to get tougher, on the various boards I'm on. And by the way, I need to, talking about that, I've got a board meeting starting at 1 o'clock. Then I think, there are a lot of issues, geopolitical as well, particularly if you're doing businesses in different countries. And, when I started out, did you ever hear about the risk register? And I haven't even mentioned cybercrime and the whole AI world that is going to change everything. And that's a whole new topic, which I won't go on to. But everything's moving so fast. And for boards, it's very difficult. And the risks are getting probably greater. And a lot of people don't want to be on boards because they see the risk being too great.
The fiduciary responsibilities.
Yeah.
Well, so you mentioned sustainability, mental health, and times getting tougher. In terms of tough conversations, what about ethics? Is that a conversation? Because in my experience on boards, Will, I never had a conversation about an ethical framework. It seems to me to be an important one, a difficult one, but rarely discussed on boards.
So, I think ethics is very important. So I'm on the board of the Barbican, and we had a whole day on ethics. Mm-hmm. Because it affects our people who work at the Barbican, it affects what artistic shows we're putting on. When we're funding, where do you get your money from? There are ethics is a big part of the Barbican board's, an area of focus for us. So I think it is important.
Mm. Well, a last question for you, Will, to let you off on time. Being knighted, I'd love for you to tell us what that experience was like for you.
It was an incredible experience at Windsor Castle. I was fortunate enough to be knighted by the King. And I definitely got it all wrong. I think I went down two knees and you went one. And then when you step back, you're meant to step back four or five paces and bow. And I stepped up and bowed straight away. So, but as the King, being as lovely as he is, does so many of these things that he wouldn't have probably even noticed it. And it was lovely to do it with my brother, who is Damien Lewis, my half brother, and he got his CBE. And he was after me. I did, being a bit of brotherly competitiveness, the knights got theirs before the CBEs. So that was, we smiled about that.
one-upsmanship. Reminds me, Will, about when I got married. And so I was got married in Paris, and in France, I did a civic wedding, and the mayor asked me, "Would you like to get married to this woman?" And so this was in French, of course. And at that time, I said "Je veux bien," which I thought meant "I want a lot." Je veux bien, and I want a lot. And it turns out that actually in French that means, yeah, why not? So know your language, know your protocols, brush up on your Shakespeare before next time. Will, thank you so much for coming on. How can someone connect with you if they're so inclined, or at least follow what you do? What are the best ways?
LinkedIn.
Right. That is it. I'll put all that in the show notes, Will.
Okay, brilliant.
Looking forward to seeing you on a paddle court. Vamos, yeah. My man.
Okay.
Thanks again.
Good weekend. Cheers.
Thanks for having listened to this episode of the Minter Dialogue podcast. If you like the show or would like to support me, please consider a donation on patreon.com/MinterDial. You can also subscribe on your favorite podcast service. And as ever, rating and reviews are the real currency for podcasts. You'll find the show notes with over 2,000 or more blog posts on MinterDial.com. Check out my documentary film and 4 books, including my last one, You Lead, How Being Yourself Makes You a Better Leader. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
A stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust is the reason, still I won't tell the lie. I sit here passively, hope for your respect, anticipating the thrill of your intellect. Maybe I tell myself there's no use in me lying. I'm a convinced man, building an urge. I'm a convinced man, to live and die submerged. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man, competition's innate. A convinced man, the arms of a woman. Despise revenges and struggle with deceit. Live for the challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man, here in these confines. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, put me to the test. I'm a convinced man,
I'm ready for an arrest.
I'm a convinced man, in the arms of a woman.
Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. They're able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcasts.